and clipped them to her itinerary, anxious to please. Hutton had that effect on people. He memorized the Marriott's number and put the book away. Then he walked out to the lobby and dialed the payphone. "I want to confirm a reservation," he said.
"Name?"
"Hutton."
"Yes, we've got that. Tonight only a suite."
"Thank you," Reacher said, and put the phone down. She would take an early flight out of D.C. After 2 decades in uniform, she would be up at 5, in a cab at 6, boarding at 7. She would be in Indianapolis by 9, latest, out of the Hertz lot by 9:30. It was a 2.5-hour drive. She would arrive at noon, in about an hour. He stepped out of the lobby and looped through the plaza and headed north and east through a thin crowd of people, past the far side of the recruiting office, past the back of the courthouse. He found the Marriott easily enough and took a corner table in its coffee shop and settled down to wait. Helen Roden called Rosemary Barr at work. She wasn't there. The receptionist sounded a little embarrassed about it. So Helen tried Rosemary's home number and got her after the second ring.
"Did they let you go?" she asked. "Unpaid leave," Rosemary said. "I volunteered for it. Everyone was acting awkward around me." "That's awful." "It's human nature. I need to make a plan. I might have to move." "I need a list of your brother's friends," Helen said. "He doesn't have any. The true test of friendship is adversity, isn't it? And nobody's visited him. Nobody's even tried. Nobody's called me to ask how he is." "I meant before," Helen said. "I need to know who he saw, who he hung out with, who knew him well, especially anyone new."
"There wasn't anyone new," Rosemary said.
"Not that I'm aware of."
"Are you sure?"
"Pretty sure."
"What about old?"
"Have you got a big piece of paper?"
"I've got a whole yellow pad."
"Well, you aren't going to need it. A matchbook cover would do it. James is a very self-sufficient person."
"He must have buddies."
"A couple, I guess," Rosemary said.
"There's a guy called Mike from the neighborhood. They talk about lawns and baseball, you know, guy stuff."
"Mike," Helen wrote, "guy stuff."
"Anyone else?"
There was a long pause.
"Someone called Charlie,"
Rosemary said.
"Tell me about Charlie," Helen said.
"I don't know much about him. I never really met him."
"How long has James known him?"
"Years."
"Including the time you lived there?"
"He never came around when I was in. I only ever saw him once. He was leaving as I was coming in. I said, 'Who was that?' James said, 'That was Charlie,' like he was an old pal."
"What does he look like?"
"He's small.
He's got weird hair, like a black toilet brush."
"Is he local?"
"I guess so."
"What was their point of contact?"
Another long pause.
"Guns," Rosemary said. "They shared an interest."
"Charlie," Helen wrote. "Guns." Donna Bianca spent some time on her cell phone and mapped out the flight schedules between D.C. and Indianapolis. She knew the onward connecting flights left on the hour and took 35 minutes. She figured a person with a courthouse appointment at 4 o'clock wouldn't aim to arrive on anything later than the 2:35, which meant leaving Indianapolis at 2, which meant getting in there at about 1:30, latest, to allow for the walk between gates, which meant leaving Washington National at 11:30 or 12, latest, which wasn't possible. The last direct flight from National to Indianapolis was at 9:30. There was a morning cluster and an evening cluster, nothing in between.
"She'll come in on the 12:35, she said.
Emerson checked his watch. 11:45. "Which means Reacher will be here soon," he said. At 11:50, a courier arrived at Helen Roden's building with 6 large cardboard cartons containing the defense's copies of the prosecution's evidence. The discovery process, mandated by the rules of due process, by the Bill of Rights, as interpreted. The courier called from the lobby, and Helen told him to come on up. He had to make 2 trips with his handcart. He stacked the boxes in the empty secretarial pen. Helen signed for them, and he left. Then she opened them. There was a mass of paperwork and dozens of photographs and 11 new VHS cassettes. They had labels with numbers neatly printed on them that referred to a notarized sheet that described them as faithful and complete copies of the parking garage's security tapes made by an independent third-party contractor. Helen took them all out and stacked them separately. She would have to take them home and use her own VCR to look at them. She didn't have a VCR in the office, or a television set. There was a television set in the Marriott's coffee shop. It was mounted high in the corner on a black articulated bracket bolted to the wall. The sound was off. Reacher watched an advertisement that featured a young woman in a filmy summer dress romping through a field of wildflowers. He wasn't sure what product was being advertised. The dress, maybe, or makeup, or shampoo, or allergy medicine. Then a news banner popped up. Noon report. Reacher checked his watch. 12, exactly. He glanced toward the reception desk in the lobby. He had a clear view. No sign of Hutton. Not yet. So he glanced back at the television. Ann Yanni was on. She seemed to be live on location, downtown, out on the street, in front of the Metropole Palace Hotel. She talked silently but earnestly for a moment, and then the picture cut to tape of dawn twilight, an alley, police barriers, a shapeless form under a white sheet. Then the picture cut again to a driver's license photograph. Pale skin, green eyes, red hair. Just under the chin, a caption was superimposed. Alexandra Dupre. Alexandra. Sandy. Now they've gone too far, Reacher thought. He shivered. Way too far. He stared at the screen. Sandy's face was still there. Then the picture cut again, back to tape of the early hours, to a head-and-shoulders shot of Emerson. A recorded interview. Yanni had her microphone shoved up under Emerson's nose. He was talking. Yanni pulled the microphone back and asked a question. Emerson talked some more. His eyes were flat and empty and tired and hooded against the bright light on the camera. Even without the sound, Reacher knew what he was saying. He was promising a full and complete investigation. "We'll get this guy," he was saying.
"I saw you from the desk," a voice said.
Then it said,
"And I thought to myself, don't I know that guy?"
Reacher looked away from the TV. Eileen Hutton was standing right there in front of him. Her hair was shorter. She had no tan. There were fine lines around her eyes, but otherwise she looked just the same as she had 14 years ago, and just as good. Medium height, slim, poised, groomed, fragrant, feminine as hell. She hadn't put on a pound. She was wearing civvies, khaki chino pants, a white tee, a blue Oxford shirt open over it, penny loafers, no socks, no makeup, no jewelry, no wedding band.
"Remember me?"
she said. Reacher nodded. "Hello, Hutton," he said. "I remember you. Of course I do. And it's good to see you again." She had a purse and a key card in her hand, a rolling carry-on with a long handle at her feet.
"It's good to see you again, too," she said. "But please, tell me it's a coincidence that you're here. Please tell me that."
Feminine as hell, except she was still a woman in a man's world, and you could still see the steel if you knew where to look, which was into her eyes. They ran like a stock ticker. Warm, warm, welcome, welcome, with a periodic bright flash, "Mess with me and I'll rip your lungs out." "Sit down," Reacher said. "Let's have lunch."
"Lunch?"
"It's what people do at lunchtime."
"You were expecting me. You've been waiting for me."
Reacher nodded, glanced back up at the TV set. Sandy's driver's license picture was on the screen again. Hutton followed his gaze.
"Is that the dead girl?" she asked. "I heard it on the radio, driving down."
"Sounds like a person should get combat pay coming here." "What did the radio say?" "There's no sound in here."
"Homicide, late last night. Local girl got her neck broken. A single blow to the right temple in an alley outside a hotel." "Not this one, I hope."
"No," Reacher said. "It wasn't this one."
"Brutal."
"I guess it was." Eileen Hutton sat down at the table, not across from him, in the chair next to him, just like Sandy at the sports bar. "You look great," he said. "You really do." She said nothing. "It's good to see you," he said again.
"Likewise," she said.
"No, I mean it."
"I mean it, too. Believe me, if we were at some Beltway cocktail party, I would be getting all misty and nostalgic with the best of them. I might still, as soon as I find out you're not here for the reason I think you're here."
"What reason would that be?"
"To keep your promise."
"You remember that?"
"Of course I do. You talked about it all one night."
"And you're here because the Department of the Army got a subpoena." Hutton nodded.
"From some idiot prosecutor."
"Roden," Reacher said.
"That's the guy."
"My fault," Reacher said.
"Christ," Hutton said. "What did you tell him?"
"Nothing," Reacher said. "I didn't tell him anything, but he told me something. He told me my name was on the defense's witness list."
"The defense list?"
Reacher nodded. "That surprised me, obviously. So I was confused. So I asked him if my name had come from some old Pentagon file."
"Not in this lifetime," Hutton said.
"As I found out," Reacher said. "But still, I had said the magic words. I had mentioned the Pentagon. The type of guy he is, I knew he would go fishing. He's very insecure. He likes his cases armor-plated, so I'm sorry."
"You should be. I get to spend 2 days in the back of beyond, and I get to perjure myself from here to breakfast time."
"You don't need to do that. You can claim national security."
Hutton shook her head. "We talked about it, long and hard. We decided to stay away from anything that draws attention. That Palestinian thing was very thin. If that unravels, everything unravels. So I'm here to swear blind that James Barr was G.I. Joe."
"You okay with that?"
"You know the Army. None of us is a virgin anymore. It's about the mission. And the mission is to keep a lid on the KC thing."
"Why did they delegate you?"
"Two birds with one stone. No good to them to send someone else and still have me out there knowing the truth. This way, I can't talk about it ever again, anywhere. Not without effectively confessing to perjury one time in Indiana. They're not dumb."
I'm surprised they still care. It's practically ancient history.
How long have you been out?
7 years.
And clearly you don't have a subscription to the Army Times.
What?
Or maybe you never knew.
Never knew what?
Where it went back then. Up the chain of command.
Division, I supposed. But maybe not all the way to the top.
It stopped on a certain colonel's desk. He was the one who nixed it.
And?
His name was Peterson.
And?
Colonel Peterson is now Lieutenant General Peterson. 3 stars. Congressional liaison, about to get his 4th star. About to be named Vice Chief of Staff of the Army.
That could complicate things, Reacher thought. Embarrassing, he said.
You bet your ass embarrassing,
Hutton said.
So believe me, this is one lid that is going to stay on. You need to bear that in mind. Whatever you want to do about your promise, you can't talk about what happened any more than I can. They would find a way to get to you.
Neither of us needs to talk about it. It's a done deal.
I'm very glad to hear it.
I think.
You think?
Ask me how they really got my name.
How did they really get your name?
From James Barr himself.
I don't believe it.
I didn't believe it either. But I do now.
Why?
We should have lunch. We really need to talk. Because I think there's someone else out there who knows.
Emerson and Bianca called it quits at 12:50. Reacher never showed. The feeder flight came in on time. Nobody that could have been a female brigadier general from the Pentagon got off. The 2 cops waited until the arrivals hall emptied out and went quiet. Then they got in their car and drove back to town. Reacher and Hutton had lunch. A waitress came over, happy to get some business out of her corner table at last. The menu was coffee shop basic. Reacher ordered a grilled cheese sandwich and coffee. Hutton went with chicken Caesar and tea. They ate and talked. Reacher ran through the details of the case. Then he ran through his theory. The perverse choice of location, the presumed coercion. He told Hutton about Niebuhr's theory of the new and persuasive friend. Told her that Barr claimed he had no new friends, and very few old ones.
Can't be a new friend anyway,
Hutton said,
because this is a multi-layered setup. There's the contemporaneous evidence and the historical parallels. Second story of a parking garage 14 years ago in KC. Second story of a parking garage here and now. Virtually the same rifle, boat-tailed sniper ammunition, and the desert boots. I never saw them before, Desert Shield. They're suggestive. Whoever scripted this for him knew all about his past, which means it isn't a new friend. It can't be. It would take years and years before Barr would feel like sharing anything about KC.
Reacher nodded. But obviously he did, eventually. Which is why I said there's someone else out there who knows.
We need to find that person,
Hutton said.
The mission is to keep the lid on this thing.
Not my mission. I don't care if this Peterson guy gets his 4th star.
But you do care that 250,000 veterans don't get their reputations trashed. The scandal would taint all of them, and they were good people.
Reacher said nothing.
It's easy enough,
Hutton said.
If James Barr doesn't have many friends, you don't have a very big pool to search through. One of them has to be the guy.
Reacher said nothing.
2 birds with 1 stone. Hutton said. You get to the puppet master, and the army gets to relax.
So why doesn't the army do it for me?
We can't afford to draw attention.
I've got operational problems, Reacher said.
No jurisdiction?
Worse than that. I'm about to get arrested.
For what?
For killing that girl behind the hotel.
What?
The puppet master doesn't like me being here. He already tried something on Monday night with that same girl as bait. So I went to see her yesterday, twice. And now they killed her, and I'm sure I'm her last unexplained contact.
Have you got an alibi?
Depends on the exact timing, but probably not. I'm sure the cops are already looking for me.
Problem,
Hutton said. Only temporary, Reacher said. Science is on my side. If her neck was broken by a single blow to her right temple, then her head rotated a little counterclockwise, which means the punch was thrown by a left-hander, and I'm right-handed. If I had hit her in the right temple, I would have knocked her out for sure, but I wouldn't have broken her neck. I would have had to do that separately, afterward.
You sure?
Reacher nodded. I used to do this stuff for a living, remember?
But will they believe you? Or will they figure you're big enough to have done it with your weak hand?
I'm not going to risk finding out.
You're going to run?
No, I'm going to stick around. But I'm going to have to stay out of their way, which will slow me down some. A lot, in fact. Which is why I said I've got operational problems.
Can I help?
Reacher smiled. It's good to see you, Hutton, he said. It really is.
How can I help?
My guess is there'll be a cop called Emerson waiting for you after you're done with your deposition. He'll ask you about me. Just play dumb. Just say, I never showed up, you didn't see me, you don't know where I am, all that kind of stuff. She was quiet for a spell.
You're upset,
she said.
I can tell.
He nodded, rubbed his face like he was washing without water. I don't care much about James Barr, he said. If someone wanted to set him up so he took the punishment he should have taken 14 years ago, that was okay with me. But this thing with the girl is different. It's way out of line. She was just a sweet, dumb kid. She meant no harm. Hutton was quiet for a moment longer.
Are you sure about the threat to Barr's sister?
She asked. I don't see any other leverage.
But there's no sign of a threat. As a prosecutor, I couldn't see entering it as a separate charge.
Why else would Barr have done what he did? Hutton didn't answer.
Will I see you later?
She asked. I've got a room not far away, he said. I'll be around.
Okay.
She said. Unless I'm already in jail. The waitress came back and they ordered dessert. Reacher asked for more coffee and Hutton got more tea. They kept on talking. Random subjects. Random questions. They had 14 years to catch up on. Helen Roden searched through these 6 cartons of evidence and found a crisp photocopy of a sheet of paper that had been found next to James Barr's telephone. It was as close as he had gotten to a personal phone book. It had 3 numbers on it, written in neat and careful handwriting. 2 were for his sister Rosemary, 1 at her condo and the other at work. The 3rd number was for Mike, the neighborhood guy. Nothing for anyone called Charlie. Helen dialed Mike's number. It rang 6 times, and cut to an answering machine. She left her office number and asked for a return call on a matter of great importance. Emerson spent an hour with a sketch artist and came up with a pretty good likeness of Jack Reacher's face. The drawing was then scanned into a computer and colorized. Dirty blonde hair, ice blue eyes, medium to dark tan. Emerson then typed the name and estimated the height at 6'5", the weight at 250, the age between 35 and 45. He put the police department's phone number on the bottom line, then he emailed it all over the place and set the printer to churn out 200 color copies. He told every prowl car driver to take a sheaf and give one to every hotel clerk and barman in town. Then he added, every restaurant, diner, lunch counter, and sandwich shop, too. James Barr's friend Mike called Helen Roden back at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She asked for his address and got him to agree to a face-to-face interview. He said he was home for the rest of the day, so she called a cab and headed out. Mike lived on James Barr's street, 20 minutes from downtown. Barr's house was visible from Mike's front yard. Both houses were similar. All the houses on the street were similar. They were 1950s ranches, long and low. Helen guessed they had all started out identical. But a half-century's worth of adding on and re-roofing and re-siding and ongoing landscaping had made them diverge in appearance. Some looked upmarket, and some still looked basic. Barr's place looked worn. Mike's place looked manicured. Mike himself was a tired 50-something who worked the morning shift at a paint wholesaler. His wife arrived home while Helen was still introducing herself. She was also a tired 50-something. Her name was Tammy, which didn't suit her. She was a part-time dental nurse. She worked 2 mornings a week for a downtown dentist. She ushered Helen and Mike into the living room and then went away to make coffee. Helen and Mike sat down and started out with an awkward initial silence that lasted minutes.
"So, what can I tell you?" Mike asked eventually.
"You were Mr. Barr's friend," Helen said.
Mike glanced at the living room door. It was open.
"Just a neighbor," he said.
"His sister called you a friend."
"We were neighborly. Some folks might call that friendly."
"Did you spend time together?"
"We would chat a little if he walked by with his dog."
"About what kind of thing?"
"Our yards," Mike said. "If he was decorating, he would ask me about paint. I asked him who fixed his driveway. Things like that."
"Baseball?"
Mike nodded.
"We would talk about that."
Tammy came in with 3 cups of coffee on a tray. There was cream and sugar and a small plate of cookies with them and 3 paper napkins. She put the tray on a low table and sat down next to her husband.
"Help yourself," she said. "Thank you," Helen said. "Thank you very much."
They all served themselves, and there was silence in the room.
"Were you ever in Mr. Barr's house?" Helen asked.
Mike glanced at his wife.
"Once or twice," he said.
"They weren't friends,"
Tammy said.
"Was it a surprise?" Helen asked. "That he did what he did?"
"Yes,"
Tammy said.
"It was."
"So you don't need to feel bad about mixing with him before. It wasn't something that anyone could have predicted. These things are always a surprise. Neighbors never know. You're trying to get him off." "Actually, I'm not," Helen said. "But there's a new theory that he didn't act alone. I'm just trying to make sure that the other man gets punished, too."
"It wasn't Mike,"
Tammy said.
"I don't think it was,"
Helen said.
"Really? Not for a moment. Not now that I've met him. But whoever the other man is, you or Mike might know him or have heard about him or even seen him coming and going."
"Barr didn't really have friends," Mike said.
"Nobody?"
"Not that he spoke about to me. He lived with his sister until she moved out. I guess that was enough for him."
"Does the name Charlie mean anything to you?"
Mike just shook his head.
"What did Mr. Barr do when he had a job?"
"I don't know," Mike said. "He hasn't worked for years."
"I've seen a man over there,"
Tammy said.
"When?"
"Now and then." Occasionally. He comes and goes, all times of the day and night, like a friend would.
For how long?
Ever since we moved here. I spend more time at home than Mike does, so I notice more.
When was the last time you saw this man?
Last week, I think. A couple of times.
Friday?
No, earlier. Tuesday and Wednesday, maybe.
What does he look like?
He's small.
He's got funny hair. Black, like hog bristles.
Charlie, Helen thought.
Eileen Hutton walked 3 fast blocks south from the Marriott and arrived at the courthouse at 4:01 exactly. Alex Roden's secretary came down to escort her up to the 3rd floor. Depositions were taken in a large conference room because most witnesses brought their own lawyers and court reporters with them. But Hutton was on her own. She sat down alone on one long side of a large table and smiled as a microphone was placed in front of her and a video camera was focused on her face. Then Roden came in and introduced himself. He brought a small team with him. An assistant, his secretary, a court reporter with her machine.
"Would you state your full name and title for the record?" he asked.
Hutton looked at the camera.
"Eileen Ann Hutton," she said. "Brigadier General, Judge Advocate General's Corps, United States Army."
"I hope this won't take long," Roden said.
"It won't,"
Hutton said.
And it didn't.
Roden was trawling in a sea he hadn't charted. He was like a man in a darkened room. All he could do was dart around randomly and hope he bumped into something. After 6 questions, he realized he was never going to. He asked,
"How would you characterize James Barr's military service?"
"Exemplary without being exceptional," Hutton said.
He asked,
"Was he ever in trouble?"
"Not to my knowledge," Hutton said.
He asked, "Did he ever commit a crime?"
"Not to my knowledge,"
Hutton said.
He asked, "Are you aware of recent events in this city?"
"Yes, I am,"
Hutton said.
He asked, "Is there anything in James Barr's past that might shed light on the likelihood, or otherwise, of his having been involved in those events?"
"Not to my knowledge,"
Hutton said.
Finally, he asked, "Is there any reason why the Pentagon might be more aware of James Barr than any other veteran?"
"Not to my knowledge,"
Hutton said. So at that point, Alex Roden gave up.
"Okay," he said. "Thank you, General Hutton."
Helen Roden walked 30 yards and stood on the street for a moment outside James Barr's house. It had police tape across the entryway and a plywood sheet nailed over the broken front door. It looked forlorn and empty. There was nothing to see. So she used her cell phone to call a cab and had it take her to the county hospital. It was after 4 o'clock in the afternoon when she arrived, and the sun was in the west. It lit up the white concrete building with pale shades of orange and pink. She rode up to the 6th floor and signed in with the Board of Corrections and found the tired 30-year-old doctor and asked him about James Barr's condition. The doctor didn't really answer. He wasn't very interested in James Barr's condition, that was clear. So Helen just walked past him and opened Barr's door. Barr was awake. He was still handcuffed to the cot. His head was still clamped. His eyes were open, and he was staring at the ceiling. His breathing was low and slow, and the heart monitor was beeping less than once a second. His arms were trembling slightly, and his handcuffs were rattling against the bed frame. Quiet, dull, metallic sounds.
"Who's there?"
he said. Helen stepped close and leaned into his field of view.
"Are they looking after you?"
she asked.
I have no complaints, he said.
Tell me about your friend Charlie. Is he here?
No, he's not here.
Did Mike come?
I don't think they allow visitors, just lawyers and family.
Barr said nothing.
Are those your only friends?
Helen said.
Mike and Charlie?
I guess, Barr said. And Mike's more of a neighbor.
What about Jeb Oliver?
Who?
He works at the auto parts store?
I don't know him.
Are you sure?
Barr's eyes moved and his lips pursed, like a man searching his memory, trying to be helpful, desperate for approval.
I'm sorry, he said. I never heard of him.
Do you use drugs?
No,
Barr said.
Never. I wouldn't do that.
He was quiet for a beat.
Truth is, I don't really do much of anything. I just live. That's why this whole thing makes no sense to me. I spent 14 years in the world. Why would I throw it all away now?
Tell me about Charlie, Helen said.
We hang out, Barr said. We do stuff?
With guns?
A little bit.
Where does Charlie live?
I don't know.
How long have you been friends?
5 years, maybe 6.
And you don't know where he lives?
He never told me.
He's been to your place.
So?
You never went to his place.
He came to mine instead.
Do you have his phone number?
He just shows up. Here and there, now and then.
Are you close?
Close enough.
How close, exactly?
We get along.
Well enough to tell him what happened 14 years ago?
Barr didn't answer, just closed his eyes.
Did you tell him?
Barr said nothing.
I think you told him,
Helen said. Barr didn't confirm or deny it.
I'm surprised that a man doesn't know where his friend lives, especially a friend as close as I think Charlie is.
I didn't push it,
Barr said.
I was lucky to have a friend at all. I didn't want to ruin it with questions.
Eileen Hutton got up from Alex Roden's deposition table and shook hands all around. Then she stepped out to the corridor and came face to face with a guy she assumed was the cop called Emerson, the one Reacher had warned her about. He confirmed it by handing her a card with his name on it. "Can we talk?" he asked.
"About what?"
she asked back.
"About Jack Reacher?" Emerson said.
"What about him?"
"You know him. Am I right?"
"I knew him 14 years ago."
"When did you last see him?"
14 years ago," she said. "We were in Kuwait together. Then he shipped out somewhere. Or I did. I can't remember."
"You didn't see him today?"
"He's in Indiana."
"He's in town. Right here. Right now."
"Small world."
"How did you get here?"
"I flew into Indianapolis and rented a car."
"Staying overnight?"
"Do I have a choice?"
"Where?"
"The Marriott."
"Reacher killed a girl last night."
"Are you sure?"
"He's our only suspect."
"That would be very unlike him."
"Call me if you see him. The station house number is on my card, and my direct extension, and my cell phone."
"Why would I see him?"
"Like you said, it's a small world."
A police black and white crawled north through the building rush hour traffic, past the gun store, past the barber shop, any style $7. Then it eased right and turned into the motor court. The cop in the passenger seat got out and walked to the office, gave the clerk a flyer, laid it flat on the counter, and swiveled it around and slid it across. "Call us if this guy shows up, okay?" the cop said.
"He's already here," the clerk said.
"But his name's Hefner, not Reacher. I put him in room 8 last night." The cop stood still.
"Is he in there now?"
"I don't know. He's come and gone a few times."
"How long did he book for?"
"He paid one night, but he didn't give the key back yet."
"So he's planning to be here again tonight?"
"I guess. Unless he's already here."
"Unless," the clerk said.
The cop stepped back to the office door, signaled his partner. His partner shut the motor down and locked the car and walked over.
"Room 8, false name," the first cop said.
"In there now?" his partner asked.
"We don't know."
"So, let's find out."
They took the clerk with them. They made him stand well back. They drew their weapons and knocked on room 8's door. No response. They knocked again. No response.
"Got a master key?"
the first cop asked. The clerk handed him a key. The cop put it in the lock gently, one-handed, turned it slowly, opened the door a half inch and paused, and then smashed it all the way open and stepped inside. His partner stepped in right behind him. Their guns traced left and right and up and down, fast and random and tense. The room was empty. Nothing in there at all, except a forlorn little sequence of bathroom items lined up on a shelf above the sink. A new pack of throwaway razors, open, one used. A new can of shaving foam, with dried bubbles around the nozzle. A new tube of toothpaste, twice squeezed.
"This guy travels light," the first cop said. "But he hasn't checked out," his partner said. "That's for sure. Which means he's coming back."
Chapter 10 Reacher was falling asleep on the bed in room 310 at the Marriott Suites. He was on his back, like a dead man. He and Hutton had talked so long in the coffee shop that she had almost been late for her appointment. She had checked her watch at 5 to 4 and had thrust her key card at him and asked him to dump her bag in her room. Then she had run straight out to the street. He guessed he was supposed to leave her card at the desk afterward, but he didn't. He didn't have anywhere he needed to be. Not right then. So he just parked the bag and stayed inside. He wasn't crazy about room 310, all things considered. It was on the 3rd floor, which made the window a difficult escape route. Room 8 at the motor court had been better. Much better. Ground floor, a tangled old neighborhood. It gave a guy a sporting chance. Open the window, step out, look for an alley or a door or another window. That was good. This was bad. He was 3 floors up, a long climb. And he wasn't even sure if the Marriott's windows opened at all. Maybe they didn't. Maybe the main office lawyers had been worried about liability. Maybe they had foreseen a steady deluge of infants raining down on the parking lot blacktop. Or maybe it was a question of economies of scale. Maybe the cost of hinges and handles outweighed a little extra on the air conditioning bill. Whatever, it wasn't a great room to be in. Not by any measure. Not for the long term. But it was okay for the short term. So he closed his eyes and drifted away. Sleep when you can, because you never know when you're going to sleep again. That was the old army rule. Emerson's plan was pretty straightforward. He put Donna Bianca in room 7. told the two patrolmen to stash their car three streets away and walk back and wait in room 9. He put a car two streets behind the motor court and another four blocks north where the auto dealers were and another two blocks south. He told the clerk to stay awake and watch through the window and call Bianca in room 7 as soon as he saw the guy he knew as Hefner walk in. Eileen Hutton got back to the Marriott at 4:30. There was no key card waiting for her at the desk, no message. So she went up in the elevator and followed the arrows to room 310 and knocked on the door. There was a short pause, and then the door opened and Reacher let her in.
"How's my room?"
she asked.
"The bed's comfortable," he said.
"I'm supposed to call Emerson if I see you," she said.
"Are you going to?"
"No."
"Perjury and harboring a fugitive," he said. "All in one day."
She dug in her purse and came out with Emerson's card.
"You're their only suspect. He gave me three separate phone numbers. They sound pretty serious."
He took the card from her, put it in his back pocket with the cocktail napkin that had Helen Roden's cell number on it. He was turning into a walking phone book.
"How was the thing with Roden?" he asked.
"Straightforward," she said.
He said nothing. She moved around, checking the suite. Bathroom, bedroom, living room, kitchenette. She took her bag and stood it neatly against a wall.
"Want to stay?"
she said.
He shook his head. "I can't," he said.
"Okay,"
she said. "But I could come back later, if you like."
She paused a beat.
"Okay,"
she said.
"Come back later."
Alex Roden stepped back into his office and closed the door and called Emerson.
"Have you got him yet?" he asked.
"Just a matter of time," Emerson said. "We're looking for him all over, and we're watching his room. He's at the old motor court, under a false name."
"That's interesting," Roden said.
"It means he might have used a false name at the Metropole, too."
"I'll check," Emerson said. "I'll show the clerk the picture."
"We might really be able to nail him," Roden said.
He clicked off, thinking about two new framed headlines for his office wall. First Bar, and then Reacher. Reacher let himself out of Hutton's suite and used the stairs instead of the elevator. On the ground floor, he turned away from the lobby and found a back corridor with a fire door at the end of it. He pushed the fire door open and held it ajar with his foot, took Emerson's card out of his pocket, and tore it in half, lengthwise, and folded the half with the name on it four times. He pressed the tongue into the fire door's lock with the ball of his thumb and wedged it there with the folded cardboard. He closed the door gently and pushed it flush with the frame with the flat of his hand. Then he walked away, past a dumpster, through the staff lot, out to the street, heading north. The sidewalks were busy, and the traffic lanes were starting to clog. He walked at a normal pace and used his height to scan the middle distance for patrol cars or cops on corners. The day was still warm. There was a weather system somewhere out there, somewhere near. There was high pressure in the sky, clamping down, trapping the smell of damp earth and nitrogen fertilizer in the air. He reached the raised highway and turned west in its shadow. The roadbed strode along on pillars 40 feet high. Underneath it were untidy lots, some vacant and full of trash, some with old brick buildings with dark skylights in their roofs, some with new metal sheds housing body shops and spray paint operations. He passed the back of the black glass tower and stayed in the highway's shadow and turned south, ready to pass behind the library. He stopped suddenly and crouched and fiddled with his shoe, like he had a stone, glanced back under his arm and saw nobody behind him. No tail. He moved on. After the library, he was exposed for 40 yards.
The plaza was east of him. He stopped momentarily on a spot he judged was directly below where Helen Roden had parked the day before and where James Barr should have parked on Friday. 40 feet lower down, the view was different, but the geometry was the same. He could see the wilted tributes propped against the pool's southern wall. They were small splashes of faded color in the distance. Beyond them was the DMV's door. People were coming out in ones and twos. He checked his watch. 10 to 5. He moved on, in the open, and made it across to First Street's northernmost block. He looped one block south and three blocks east, and came up on the parking garage's entrance from the west. He walked up the ramp and found the security camera's lens. It was a small circle of dirty glass mounted on a plain black box that was bolted high up in the angle of two concrete beams. He waved at it. It was too high, ideally. It should have been lower, at license plate level. But all the pillars below waist height were scuffed and scraped, a rainbow of different colors. Drivers were careless. Mounted lower, the camera would have lasted a day and a half, maybe less. He walked up the ramps to the second level, headed north and east to the far back corner. The garage was still and quiet, but full. The space that James Barr had used was occupied. No room for sentiment in the scramble for downtown parking. No room for reverence. The border between the old garage and the new construction was marked by a triple barrier of tape strung between pillars. There was standard yellow and black contractors' caution do not enter tape, and above it and below it were new lengths of blue and white police line do not cross tape. He used his forearm and stretched all three lines higher and just ducked underneath. No need to drop to one knee. No need to scuff a pair of jeans. No need to leave a mess of fibers. Not even for a guy 6 inches taller than Barr. And not even with a new line of tape 6 inches lower than the one Barr had encountered. He was literally going out of his way to leave every last piece of evidence he could. Reacher walked on into the gloom. The new construction was rectangular in shape, maybe 40 yards south to north, maybe 200 east to west, which meant Reacher arrived at the new northeast corner after 35 paces. He stood 6 feet back from the perimeter wall and looked down and right. He had a perfectly good view, no need to press up against a pillar, no need to squirm around like a horse on its back in a summer meadow. He stood there and watched. People were coming out of the government office in increasing numbers. There was quite a flow. Some paused and lit cigarettes as soon as they were out in the air. Others moved on directly west, some fast, some slow. All of them turned and tracked around the north end of the pool. None of them walked where Barr's victims had walked. The funeral tributes were a disincentive, a reminder. Therefore, it was hard to judge what Friday's scene had looked like. Hard, but not impossible. Reacher watched the walking people, and in his mind made them forego their respectful right turns. He made them continue straight on. They would be slow entering the bottleneck, but not too slow, and they would be close. The combination of moderate speed and proximity would exaggerate the deflection angles. It would make the job harder. It was a basic principle of long gun use. A bird traversing the sky 100 yards away was an easy target. The same bird at the same speed, flying 6 feet in front of your face, was an impossible target. He pictured the people streaming right to left. He closed one eye and extended his arm and pointed his finger. Click, 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 click. 6 aimed shots, 4 seconds. fast. Tough geometry. Tension. Exposure. Vulnerability. 6 hits, including the deliberate miss. Exceptional shooting. They don't forget. He dropped his arm to his side. It was cold in the gloom. He shivered. The air was clammy and damp and full of the smell of lime. It had been hot in Kuwait City. The air had been shimmering and full of the smell of baked dust and desert sand. Reacher had stood in the parking garage and sweated. The street below him had been blinding, murderous, like a blast furnace. Hot in Kuwait City. 4 shots there. 6 shots here. He stood and watched the people coming out the DMV door. There were plenty of them. 10, 12, 15, 20. They turned and looped north, and then turned again and walked west between the pool and the NBC Peacock. They gave each other space, but if they had been in the bottleneck, they would have bunched up tight. Plenty of them. 6 shots in 4 seconds. He looked for anyone not moving. Didn't see anybody. No cops, no old men in boxy suits. He turned around and retraced his steps, lifted the tape again and ducked under it and walked back down the ramps, slipped out to the street and turned west, heading for the shadows under the highway, heading for the library. He crossed the 40 yards of open ground and hugged the library's side wall and went in through a handicapped entrance. He had to walk close to the desk, but he wasn't worried about that. If Emerson started circulating wanted notices, he would hit the post offices and bars and hotels first. It would be a long time before he started canvassing librarians. He made it to the lobby okay, and stepped over to the payphones, took the cocktail napkin out of his pocket and dialed Helen Roden's cell. She picked up on the 5th ring. He pictured her rooting through her purse, squinting at the screen, fumbling with the buttons. "Are you alone?" he asked.
"Reacher?"
"Yes," he said. "Are you alone?"
"Yes," she said. "But you're in trouble."
"Who called you?"
"My father."
"You believe him?"
"No."
"I'm coming to see you."
"There's a cop in the lobby."
"I figured. I'll come in through the garage."
He hung up and walked back past the desk and out the side entrance, back under the highway. He stayed in its shelter until he was opposite the back of the black glass tower, opposite the vehicle ramp. He checked left, checked right, and walked straight down, past the NBC trucks, past the Mustang, he figured, for Ann Yanni's, to the elevator. He pressed the call button and waited, checked his watch. 5:30. Most people would be leaving the building. A down elevator was certain to stop at the lobby level. An up elevator? Maybe not, he hoped. The elevator car arrived in the garage and let 3 people out. They walked away. Reacher stepped in, pressed 4, stood back. The car rose 1 floor and stopped. In the lobby. The doors slid back like a theater curtain. The cop was right there, 4 feet from the elevator, facing away. He had his feet apart and his hands on his hips. He was almost close enough to touch. A man stepped into the elevator. He didn't speak, just nodded a 2 guys in an elevator greeting. Reacher nodded back. The guy pressed 7. The doors stayed open. The cop watched the street. The new guy jiggled the button. The cop moved. He swiped his cap off his head and ran his fingers through his hair. The doors closed. The elevator moved up. Reacher got out on 4 and walked through a small knot of people on their way home. Helen Roden had her door open and ready. He stepped inside her suite and she closed up after him. She was wearing a short black skirt and a white blouse. She looked young, like a schoolgirl, and she looked worried.